Could it be on the first day of Tabernacles that Sinwar, the mastermind of the October 7th massacre, is dead?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, biblical scholar and cultural commentator, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice for moral sanity and spiritual clarity. Call 866-34-TRUTH to get on The Line of Fire. And now, here's your host, Dr. Michael Brown.
Day of Sukkot began last night at sunset. Word began to leak out this morning that there was the possibility that the mastermind of the October 7th massacre, Yahya Sinwar, was killed randomly, accidentally, by the IDF operating in Rafah yesterday, last night, now this morning, now today. It's confirmed. It's confirmed by DNA. Sinwar is dead. This is Michael Brown. Welcome to The Line of Fire. There's a lot to unpack, a lot to talk about today, but phone lines are open for your Jewish-related calls, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. Let me first give you a little history and background to Sinwar. He was leader in Hamas. He personally killed different people, he thought they were defectors, strangled them with his own hands, was known for this. He was ultimately in an Israeli prison. There was a dentist that got to know him, spoke with him personally. This dentist ended up becoming an intelligence agent for Israel. But this dentist said that Sinwar said it would be worth 100,000, 200,000 Gazans dying, Palestinians dying to get some of their prisoners freed. Well, he gets a brain tumor in Israeli prisons. Israeli doctors operate on him. His life is saved. And when the Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit, who had been in captivity held by Hamas in Gaza for 5 years, when he was released, Sinwar was one of 1,027 Palestinian prisoners, many of whom had blood on their hands. In other words, they were murderers. They were released by Israel. Sinwar, in prison, learned Hebrew, better understood the Israeli mindset, and became a key leader in Hamas and was the mastermind of the October 7th massacre. And Israel has been doing everything it's known how to do to find him, to locate him, and to take him out. There was even speculation that when he was out from under the tunnels, that he would travel dressed as a woman, masquerading as a woman so he wouldn't be spotted. There are pictures taken. Could that be him? In any case, Israel some weeks back said, all right, you have safe passage. You and anyone you want to bring with you if you release all the remaining hostages. Unconditionally release all the remaining hostages, dead or alive. Those that are dead, release the bodies. Those that are alive, release them alive. And you can leave. And many said, well, how in the world could he possibly do that? How in the world could he possibly save face and do that and be accepted in the larger Muslim world? In any case, that offer was not acted on. And as I've been reading about things, the speculation was, well, he's waiting for a regional war. He's hoping that something will erupt as a regional war and that will turn the tide. Or others speculated that he's just resigned to the fact he's not going to get out. So he's surrounded by hostages. So the only way that he dies is if many hostages die. And that's the plan. But again, this was all speculation. So Israel has been operating in Rafah. So this is in southern Gaza. And one of the key areas has been what's called the Philadelphia Corridor. This was the border between Egypt and Gaza that Israel had secured up until 2005. But after that, it became very porous, which is how terrorists have come in and out, how weapons have been exported in, imported in even more. And of course, tunnels dug with more freedom and impunity to go in and out of Egypt secretly. So Israel had a lot of resistance from America to overcome in terms of going into Rafah. America said, you can't until you secure things humanitarily. It's going to take a long period of time. Well, in basically 3 weeks, Israel successfully relocated 1 million Gazans, 1 million Palestinians, moved them out of the battle zone in tent cities, and then has been decimating Hamas resistance there in Rafah. And from what we understand yesterday, I'm trying to get the exact time. Was it the evening that this happens? I don't have the exact time. I'm trying to find that. But Israel engages in a firefight with three terrorists. They understand they're, because they've been squeezing in more and more and more on the last vestige of the Hamas senior leadership, squeezing in more and more, but still not knowing where Sinwar was. And then they engage in a firefight, mortar blast from IDF. They have to wait to get in the building. The building's booby-trapped, and they go in, and the soldiers find three Hamas terrorists. What? One of them looks just like Sinwar. How could it be? Sinwar's not just going to be out there fighting with other terrorists. What? How could it be? But the reports are out. When I get up this morning, I see Sinwar dead. Highly likely Sinwar's dead. What? And then from 30 minutes ago or 40 minutes ago until now everywhere the word's out, DNA test. Read that one of his fingers was cut off to expedite DNA testing, but then they have teeth, they have other things. His body's been taken out. He's dead. Now think of this. This does not minimize the suffering of all those who were killed, who were raped, who were kidnapped, who were traumatized, who were wounded. This does not minimize or take away the wounds, the suffering. This does not bring dead people back to life. Nor does this minimize the suffering of the people of Gaza, who suffered terribly because of Hamas and Israel having to take Hamas out. The consequences have been absolutely dramatic and horrific for the people of Gaza as a result of Israel taking out Hamas and the war that's ensued. So this does not lessen the suffering. It does not remove the horror of the fact that babies were killed and women were raped and families burned to death. It doesn't minimize any of that. And we know for a fact that none of this could have happened on October 7th from a natural perspective if Israel had listened to warnings, if there had not been a certain level of arrogance that everything was safe, if Israel had not been so terribly divided with massive protests, anti-government protests, and there was argument on each side for the different cases, but Israel massively divided as a nation, some right-wing Israeli extremism causing more upheaval in Judea Samaria called the West Bank. So Israel is also focused on that and took some of its focus off the border with Gaza with Hamas. So for sure, the tragedy of October 7th could not have happened without massive systemic failure on the part of Israeli security, the IDF government, and there is responsibility that must be had there. But since that time, Israel has utterly decimated Hamas, and now senior leader, political leader Ismail Haniyeh, when he's in Tehran, he's killed. Israel knew where he stayed, his guest house, and he and his bodyguard, that's it. Those are the ones that died. This is part of what's caused Tehran to say we have to fight back against Israel. So then Sinwar's opponent, okay, then you are, because otherwise Haniyeh was safe in Qatar. And apparently a billionaire, safe there, and certainly thinks he's going to be safe in Tehran. Israel takes him out. Now, Sinwar, who became the de facto leader of everything, military, political, he's gone, and he was the mastermind. He was the one driving this. From everything we understand, he was the ultimate decision maker, especially with the death of Haniyeh, as far as hostages being released. Israel's now said to those holding the hostages, you'll be spared. You won't be killed. Just release the hostages. Just release them. Wouldn't that be glorious? Prayers that have been prayed, wouldn't that be glorious if that actually happened with all the massive prayer and crying out and colleagues of mine who've been praying and fasting and massive prayer in D.C. on Saturday for breakthroughs? May it be that the hostages go free. But Israel has also completely decimated Hezbollah. The leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, taken out. His replacement, immediately after replacing him, taken out. From what I understand, the replacement of his replacement, taken out. It's basically, who's the leader? Not me. I don't want to die. And other senior leaders taken out. Senior Iranian leaders taken out. And who knows, the senior Iranian leader that went down in the helicopter crash, was it just a crash? Could be that the helicopter's outdated and people were concerned about that in general. Was there anything else that went on? I mean, Israel's certainly not taking credit for it. Israel has not been largely blamed for that, as say, in the death of Haniyeh. Obviously, Israel did that. The pagers exploding and decimating thousands wounded of Hezbollah militants, many killed. Then with the walkie-talkie explosions, death of certain leaders in Syria. Israel has fought back in ways that almost seems supernatural. You say, what about the babies who died in Gaza? I don't mean that everything Israel did is perfect or good or right. And I don't mean that every child that died in Gaza, God killed them. I am not saying that. I am saying Israel is in an existential battle. And Israel has said to the world, you do not mess with us without dire consequences. Now, when it comes to Sukkot, it's supposed to be a time of celebrating. And Sinwar launches his horrific mastermind attack on the 50th anniversary of the Yom Kippur War from 73. So on the first Sabbath of October of 73, then the first Sabbath of October 2023, another massacre on a Jewish holy day, but this one, Simchat Torah, being the day of rejoicing. And who's going to rejoice? How can you rejoice now? How can you sing and dance and rejoice when the hostages are still in captivity and Israel's still reeling? Well, now there's going to be more cause for rejoicing. Yes, I mourn over the death of every human being who dies without Jesus, who could have lived a very different life and served God and glorified him. I mourn over that, but I am rejoicing in God's faithfulness and grace and goodness, and recognizing that one of the worst mass murderers of our time, full of devious evil, is dead on the first day of Tabernacles. I don't think that is just a coincidence, personally. All right, we will be right back here on The Line of Fire. Thanks for staying with us.
This is Michael Ellison, founder of Tribeuta Wellness. I want you to hear an amazing testimony from my friend James Robison, and most all of you will know of him. He and his wife Betty host the Life Today television program. Now here is James.
Let me tell you about a miracle I experienced. My friend Michael Ellison, he and his wife are our 40-year plus best friends. Well, let me just say this to you. I had so much pain with what was called tennis elbow that I could hardly reach over and pick up the phone without pain, without it hurting me. I couldn't pick up something to drink, a glass of tea or anything. It was very difficult to do anything without wearing a tight strap. And then Michael shared the Nopal cactus juice with me, Nopalea. I began drinking about that much in the morning in a glass and that much later in the day. And in 3 months, I was a different person. I have now gone more than 10 years with no pain. Not better, well, I have no joint pain. I'm telling you, it did something to the inflammation in my body that was undeniable. Now, that's just my testimony. But that's been more than 10 years with no pain. Matter of fact, if I miss, for some foolish reason, a few days, I can feel it creeping back that fast. So give it a try. See if it helps relieve your pain. I hope it does like it has mine, because it worked for me.
Nopalea is supported by clinical studies for lowering inflammation and improving mobility, flexibility, and range of motion in the neck, back, and joints for less reliance on pain medication and improved quality of life. Call 800-771-5584 and use promo code BROWN25 to receive 25% off your order. As a new customer, 100% of your order goes to support the Line of Fire. Call 800-771-5584 or go online to trivita.com.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get on the Line of Fire by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us on Jewish Thursday, this first day of Sukkot, with the breaking news confirmed that the leader of Hamas, his name is alternately pronounced Yahya Sinwar or Yahya Sinwar, is now dead in a random battle, accidental from the Israeli point of view. In other words, they didn't know Sinwar was there. They didn't know they were targeting him. Didn't know they were killing him. Now dead. And hopefully, this can speed the release of the hostages and hopefully speed the end of Hamas influence in Gaza. Hopefully, if a humanitarian government that can be raised up will say to Israel, okay, we can be neighbors, and with all the aid that comes in, we'll pour it into infrastructure, education, building hospitals, building apartments, job opportunities, so the people of Gaza can have a future. This could be good news all around. Or if you have a Jewish-related question of any kind, give me a call, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884 is the number to call. There are two streamers with massive, massive online followings in the hundreds of millions, Osman Gold and Hassan Piker. Osman Gold made some comments on Twitch, big channel on Twitch, and Twitch is known as a social media outlet that has a lot of anti-Israel posts, anti-Semitic posts that are allowed to stand. But Osman Gold makes a statement in one of his broadcasts, and it gets him banned. It gets him deplatformed there on Twitch. We muted out some of the bad language, but listen to what he had to say.
If you want to consider a genocide as a systematic killing of a group of people, they have genocide built into Sharia law right now. So no, I'm not going to cry a f-ing river when people who have genocide that's baked into their laws are getting genocided. I don't give a f-. They're terrible people. It's not even a question. It's crazy that people don't see it that way. They'd be doing the same thing. And how much did they kill? As many as they can. They're not able to kill as many people as Israel because they don't have as many bombs and as many weapons. But if they did, they'd be doing the same thing. That's it. Just takes enough. That's right. These people are not your allies. They are not the same as us. They come from an inferior culture that is horrible. It kills people for their identity, and it is directly antithetical to everything Western values stand for, and it is an inferior culture in all ways. It is that simple. No, I don't feel bad for them. I don't feel sorry for them. I don't care. I don't support them.
All right, so what he's saying about radical Islam is very true, and Sharia law. And radical Muslims will seek to export Islam and extend the rule of Islam through violence. And we'll see Allah's enemies as their enemies and people against whom they should do violence. Israel being at the top of the list, America being at the top of the list. And obviously, as far as a culture, Sharia law with everything that it brings, yeah, is inferior to a culture that's been influenced by Judeo-Christian values. Now, Osman Gold did subsequently say, look, he lives in the streaming world, and apologized for the insensitivity of his comments. But what he's saying is true, that Israel, and it wasn't making a positive Israel statement here, but I'll say this, that Israel taking out Hamas terrorists with there then being consequence that civilians die is very different than radical Islam saying we're going to slaughter all the civilians we can. All right, so he's deplatformed now. So he comes on with Hassan Piker, and they are now going to interact on this point. So I want to interact with a couple of clips because this is massive news, especially the young men who follow these two influential streamers. So let's listen to this. This is Osman Gold and Hassan Piker.
Basically, the reason why I don't like what they do is because it's based off of a religious theocracy. And so you can look at other religious theocracies in other countries that aren't being bombed. And the one commonality that they have is that they all suppress people's identity and they express their freedom of expression. And I think that any culture and any type of government that is derivative of a religion is fundamentally inferior. I think this is true with any book. It's true with Judaism. It's true with Christianity. It's true with Islam. It's true with Hinduism. I think it's true with anything. And I find it to be very problematic that we're using these books as a guideline for like how to make laws when these books actively encourage killing people for different types of identities. And obviously, like, I understand that there's like a huge spectrum of people that are part of any culture. There's people that are way more progressive, people that are way less progressive. But what I see is that I see countries that have laws that haven't been bombed, right? You look at like Saudi Arabia or like Dubai. A lot of these other countries still have the same types of expressions or same type of restrictions on the expression for LGBT. Mm-hmm. And I find that to be problematic and inferior. And I think that you could make, I want to make sure that this is very clear, because like, I don't want you to think that this is something that's like a, the brown people over there are wrong. I would say the exact same thing for us, you know, like the church, you know, like Christianity. Like if you look at, for example, like Salem witch trials, it's disgusting. It's horrible. So all I'm saying is that I think that there is a standard that's being applied, and I don't really understand how that's defensible at all. I don't like, and that's what doesn't make sense to me.
Is it's that, not.
And like, okay, it's well, not. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
But here is the problem.
Okay.
It's not defensible, but I think most people, including like the gay Palestinians or queer Palestinians or queer Lebanese people, understand anything. That there is no room for advocating for civil liberties in your own domestic policies when you are escaping bombings.
All right. So let me interact with several of those statements that were being made. You cannot compare a society that seeks to live out Judeo-Christian values with a society that practices radical Islam. The values will be different. The treatment of women will be different. The freedoms allowed will be different. That's just a fact. The freedoms that exist in America, the what helped America become great were the foundations that were Judeo-Christian foundations, biblical principles that were put into law and lived out. And the fact that you had something like slavery, that was an aberration. That's why there was always Christian resistance to it, because the Bible does not sanction kidnapping and enslaving of other peoples. So there is a mixture together here, as if the biblical faith lived out, which has been so liberating for hundreds of millions of people worldwide, can be equated to radical Islam and Sharia law. You're comparing apples with oranges. Maybe the extreme, the comparison is much more extreme than that. Like I say, apples to elephants in terms of reality. Where the gospel goes, you'll see that women are liberated. Where the gospel goes, you'll see that there's a call for marriage fairness, that a husband has responsibilities to faithfulness along with the wife. You'll see freedom and you've been thriving, and which is why you have to point to the Salem witch trials, which of course are exaggerated through history as something much bigger than they actually were. The reality is that this too is an aberration in American history. Why haven't you had it through all this? Well, why is it one time we can point to? Show me all the witch trials in the 1700s and the 1800s and the 1900s and into the 21st century in those parts of America that are very strongly Christian. You're not seeing that happen. Those things are aberrant. Whereas what the Taliban are doing in Afghanistan, what ISIS sought to do in Iraq and other countries, that was in keeping with radical Islam. It is radical Islamic leaders who say, we love death, you love life. You don't find Christian leaders making those statements. All right, more comments on the other side of the break.
It's our world. They can never have it. It's
This is Michael Ellison, founder of Tributa Wellness. I want you to hear an amazing testimony from my friend, James Robison, and most all of you will know of him. He and his wife, Betty, host the Life Today television program. Now, here is James.
Let me tell you about a miracle I experienced. My friend, Michael Ellison, he and his wife are our 40-year-plus best friends. Well, let me just say this to you. I had so much pain with what was called tennis elbow that I could hardly reach over and pick up the phone without pain, without it hurting me. I couldn't pick up something to drink, a glass of tea or anything. It was very difficult to do anything without wearing a tight strap. And then Michael shared the Nopal cactus juice with me, Nopalea. I began drinking about that much in the morning in a glass and that much later in the day. And in 3 months, I was a different person. I have now gone more than 10 years with no pain. Not better, well, I have no joint pain. I'm telling you, it did something to the inflammation in my body that was undeniable. Now, that's just my testimony. But that's been more than 10 years with no pain. Matter of fact, if I miss, for some foolish reason, a few days, I can feel it creeping back that fast. So give it a try. See if it helps relieve your pain. I hope it does like it has mine, because it worked for me.
Nopalea is supported by clinical studies for lowering inflammation and improving mobility, flexibility, and range of motion in the neck, back, and joints for less reliance on pain medication and improved quality of life. Call 800-771-5584 and use promo code BROWN25 to receive 25% off your order. As a new customer, 100% of your order goes to support the Line of Fire. Call 800-771-5584 or go online to Trivita.com.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get on the Line of Fire by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Yes, Mahafta et Adonai Lohecha, shall love the Lord your God. All your heart, with all your mind, with all your strength, with all your life, with all your being. Fundamental calling on the Jewish people. Fundamental calling on every follower of Jesus, Yeshua. Phone lines are open. It's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. If you've got a Jewish-related question, 866-348-7884. Another thought on the comment by Osman Gold along with Hassan Piker, as they're talking about, quote, religious theocracies. I, too, fear a religious theocracy, meaning where Christianity would take over America and impose Christianity on the nation. That would be absolutely destructive. I absolutely support Christian influence in society, advocating for what we believe is right. You say, yeah, well, that means suppressing same-sex marriage and same-sex love. Yeah, true. If we had more positive influence in society and more influence in the courts and the laws, then marriage never would have been redefined. But I have a question in general. Do you think that anything should be outlawed? In other words, should polygamy be allowed? Is that okay? Or you say, no, whatever, adults, consenting adults, whatever they want to do. Okay, some want to lower the age of consent and say we've got these prudish ideas here in America and it's out of keeping with reality and history. We need to lower the age of consent. Do you have a conviction about that? Do you have a conviction about what drugs should be legal? Should all drugs be legalized? In other words, we all have moral convictions. You might say, I'm good with same-sex marriage, but I don't think it should be more than two people. So the polygamous stuff and polygyny and all, I'm not good with any of that. Oh, okay, so maybe you have that view. Or, hey, throuple, whatever, I'm good with it. Or maybe you say the age of consent should, yeah, it's prudish, it's outdated, and we should drop it a year. You may have these different viewpoints. We'll argue about these things. Our viewpoint is that for human thriving, for the good of a society, that marriage must be maintained as the union of a man and a woman. And here are the reasons for it. And it will be for the overall benefit and good of society. And some people will not have their relationships recognized by the government. That's the reality. And we, that is, we believe, ultimately best. And that we'd say if you go the direction of LGBT, you end up with the T, the Q, the genital mutilation, surgical castration of children, and all kinds of things happening, bizarre things happening in the name of rights and justice. We say, no, that's not for the best. But I've got a question for you. Is America today a more innocent place than it was 50 years ago? Are American families stronger today than they were 50 years ago? As a young woman, safer from rape, is it likely that the guy that your daughter's dating has a porn problem? You know, where are kids raised in more stable environments? You have to say there's been a lot of societal degeneration, some positive steps with equality for women and social rights for getting rid of segregation, other horrors like that. But overall, we're going in the wrong direction in so many categories. We say, yeah, that's what happens when certain doors are open. So we believe that the values we hold to are best for human thriving. We're not trying to set up a theocracy. We're simply advocating within our democratic republic for our values like everybody else gets to. And so to the extent we can change hearts and minds and lives, it'll be best for America overall. Okay, let's now listen to Hassan Piker. Again, the question is, how much liberty and freedom is there under Sharia law, under Christian views for LGBT practice and relationships? So now they're going to continue on this theme.
Not only I think you're wrong on the history of queer culture in Arab countries, in Muslim nations in general. I'll give you one example. The Ottoman Empire actually decriminalized homosexuality in the Tanzimat era. I think it was like 18th century. Mm-hmm. And before then, it was not even like a problem. It was never an issue. Far before Western nations ever actually... decriminalized or made it legal to be gay. And this is oftentimes a not really mentioned aspect of the Muslim world or Muslim culture or the Arab history or the region's history at all. Most people don't know this, and it's like genuinely shocking to them. You might maybe even be shocked to find out that the Ottoman Empire, where Palestine was seen as a safe haven for Jews as they were escaping the Spanish Inquisition, for example, and many other pogroms that Jewish people experienced in, especially in Western and Eastern Europe. The Ottoman Empire and the MENA region, all the way that spans to Morocco, was seen as a safe haven and safe harbor for Jews, where they were allowed to coexist in far better conditions under Islamic rule, technically, tolerant.
I would go even farther than you are. I think that back then it wasn't just the fact that they were accepting of gay. I think that they were way more scientifically oriented. They were way more focused on learning and mathematics. I think that's evidently true. I don't think anybody would say the Ottoman Empire was or anything like that. I think they were very progressive for their time. It's not even a question. So I totally agree with you.
But things have changed in the region since then.
They sure have.
So what do you think is the difference there? Like, what do you think has happened in the hundreds of years that have passed, that have gone by, or especially in the last 100 years? Why has the attitude overall in terms of governance changed so dynamically and so dramatically?
I think there's probably a bunch of different reasons for it, right? I mean, it's not like one reason, but I don't think that are we trying to imply that it's like American imperialism and interventionism that's caused this to happen? Is that kind of like
absolutely.
Where you're going with
no,
this?
No, I am saying that.
Yeah.
America not only directly armed and radicalized fundamentalists in the region, including but not limited to Afghanistan, for example, with the Mujahideen, because they were seen as like a fighting force that they could use against the communist adjacent Afghan government or the USSR inevitably when the USSR did invade. But also beyond that, the most nationalistic or the most militant fundamentalists were perceived in Iran, for example, as the true liberators that were not willing to fight against the Western-backed Shah regime, the Western-backed monarchy in Iran. So that's the reason why a lot of people, whether they agreed with it or not, ultimately on the social front, doesn't really matter. They were like, these guys are going to protect us. These guys are actually fighting back against this this ruthless rule of the Shah that was, you know, falsely torturing people on a regular basis.
Okay, so that's usually how your argument is that. Well, how do you reconcile that with the fact that there are other countries like Saudi Arabia, for example, that don't have that history but still have the same laws?
Oh, that's a great example. Saudi Arabia is allowed to exist like that because they have a valuable resource that they are gladly and willingly coordinating with the Western powers on.
All right, so let me interact with those comments. I appreciate the discussion, and things always are nuanced. You can't just make blanket statements about a religion that goes back to the 600s and that has over 1.5 billion followers and adherents today, just like you can't make blanket statements about, quote, Christianity. But a few things we want to dismantle there. There are texts in the Quran that don't specifically say homosexual practice, but are understood to mean that. And then hadith, so that traditional Islamic scholars have said that homosexual practice is wrong. Now, I've been told by folks who work in the Muslim world and even in religious Muslim communities that homosexual practice is rampant. It's just underground. And then in countries like Afghanistan, you have examples of boys that are made to dress like girls and then men sexually abuse them, and that's just part of the culture. So we're not saying that the practice does not exist, but their point is there are times much more tolerant. Times of the Ottoman Empire where things were more tolerant, for sure, for sure. So that's going to happen. There's going to be variance in how deeply religious the practices are. Do the countries become more secular? And there's no question, say, in Iran in the late 1970s with Ayatollah Khomeini exiled by the Shah and now getting his messages that as he's teaching in France, they were now being sent into Iran. Cassette tapes were then multiplied, sent out to all the mullahs who would preach his messages on Friday, and it led to the overthrow of the Shah. Before Khomeini even arrived in Iran, the Shah had to flee for his life, and Khomeini was looked at as a national savior by many, and that's part of the modern Islamic revolution around the world. And then you trace it back to the Muslim Brotherhood, and you could say, okay, that goes back a few more decades, and some of this is fighting against the West and imperialism. There's truth to that. And America trying to let's get rid of Russia and Afghanistan, helps arm the Mujahideen, and then out of that, you have the origins, say, of Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden and the Taliban. That can happen. Israel initially was not hostile to Hamas, even thought, okay, Hamas can be the religious opposition to the Palestinian Authority and the PLO that are not religious Muslims, and they could be like a counterpoint, not realizing what they were helping to allow to grow. So these miscalculations can happen. This is part of world history. You take down this dictator, something worse happens. You take out Saddam Hussein, you leave this void that ISIS fills, it leads to horrific suffering in the region. So that happens all the time. But here's where I want to push back. Saudi Arabia is based on Salafism or Wahhabism. So I want to make sure I have the dates correct. Muhammad ibn Abd al-Wahhab, 1703 to 1792. He's the founder of this. This is not a reaction to 20th century Western imperialism or post-World War I redividing the countries there and now establishing boundaries for the Middle East. Okay, you have this country, you have this country, this country. No, this is long before that. And this was a movement that was a Islamic fundamentalist movement. So the modern origins of the ideology of Saudi Arabia are not a reaction to imperialism. It goes way before that. And then you go back centuries before that, Hassan al-Sabah in the 11th, 12th centuries with the assassins from the Arabic word hashashin, because they would use hash, smoke hashish, then go out and kill. Political killings in the name of Islam. Radical Islam's been here through the centuries. Let's not downplay that or deny it.
I'm Paul. This is Michael Ellison, founder of Tribeta Wellness. I want you to hear an amazing testimony from my friend, James Robison, and most all of you will know of him. He and his wife, Betty, host the Life Today television program. Now, here is James.
Let me tell you about a miracle I experienced. My friend, Michael Ellison, he and his wife are our 40-year-plus best friends. Well, let me just say this to you. I had so much pain with what was called tennis elbow that I could hardly reach over and pick up the phone without pain, without it hurting me. I couldn't pick up something to drink, a glass of tea or anything. It was very difficult to do anything without wearing a tight strap. And then Michael shared the Nopal cactus juice with me, Nopalea. I began drinking about that much in the morning in a glass and that much later in the day. And in 3 months, I was a different person. I have now gone more than 10 years with no pain. Not better, well, I have no joint pain. I'm telling you, it did something to the inflammation in my body that was undeniable. Now, that's just my testimony. But that's been more than 10 years with no pain. Matter of fact, if I miss for some foolish reason a few days, I can feel it creeping back that fast. So give it a try. See if it helps relieve your pain. I hope it does like it has mine, because it worked for me.
Nopalea is supported by clinical studies for lowering inflammation and improving mobility, flexibility, and range of motion in the neck, back, and joints for less reliance on pain medication and improved quality of life. Call 800-771-5584 and use promo code BROWN25 to receive 25% off your order. As a new customer, 100% of your order goes to support the Line of Fire. Call 800-771-5584 or go online to trivita.com.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get on the Line of Fire by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Are you receiving our monthly frontline newsletter? We just sent one out. Talk about the church and the elections and keeping our spiritual priorities. Excerpts from my book, The Political Seduction of the Church. Hebrew word study on the word rachamim, compassion, explaining why it's a plural form in Hebrew. A great testimony from England, some of our grads working there. You're not getting it still? You've heard me talk about it 100 times and you still don't have it? Okay, so here's again. It's free. It's digital. No strings attached. We just want to get it into your hands. Go to thelineoffire.org, thelineoffire.org, and click subscribe. It's that simple. So and when you do, then go look in your spam folder, your junk folder, because that's where the email will come first, because you don't know what's coming. And then make sure you can get those in your inbox subsequently. That's thelineoffire.org. Click subscribe. All right, I haven't done this in a while. If you have a Jewish-related question and you're watching on YouTube, go ahead and post it. Go ahead and post it, but post it like this, at the Line of Fire, and then go ahead and post your question. So post it as at the Line of Fire, and go ahead and post your question, and I'll try to get to some YouTube questions before I'm done. Prime Minister Netanyahu addressed the nation a little while ago and addressed the people of Israel and said this, Yahya Sinwar planned and executed. No, I'm sorry, this is a statement from the IDF. Yahya Sinwar planned and executed the October 7th massacre, promoted his murderous ideology both before and during the war, and was responsible for the murder and abduction of many Israelis. Yahya Sinwar was eliminated after hiding for the past year behind the civilian population of Gaza, both above and below ground in Hamas tunnels in the Gaza Strip. According to Prime Minister Netanyahu, so this is not long ago, Sinwar's death, that Hamas suffered a heavy blow. The war in Gaza is not yet over. Netanyahu added that Hamas will no longer rule Gaza. This is the beginning of the day after Hamas, and this is an opportunity for you, the residents of Gaza, to finally break free from its tyranny. Netanyahu also said Sinwar ran away in fear from our soldiers prior to being killed. He told you he was a lion, but in reality, he was hiding in a dark den, and he was killed when he fled in a panic from our soldiers. The darkness has been retreating, and the light has been shining. Yeah, again, extraordinary events, especially now on the first day of Sukkot. And may it be, may this be a day for a better future, not just for the people of Israel, but for the people of Gaza as well. But they're going to have to lay down their murderous hatred of Israel. You say, but now, how can they? After they've been so decimated by Israeli bombings, and especially the early part of the campaign, there's been much less talk about, quote, genocide when so few civilians have died in recent weeks and months comparatively. And it's been largely terrorists taken out one after another after another. But still, great suffering. America's pressured Israel. You've got to get even more aid into the people. But many have recognized, from what we understand anecdotally and various reports, many Gazans have recognized it's Hamas who brought the suffering on them, and Hamas who's been massively funded. I remember talking to some Palestinians some years ago when I did a debate with a Christian colleague about Israel at Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary. And they were very anti-Israel, but they hated their leaders. They absolutely hated the Palestinian leaders. They thought they were all corrupt and bad leaders, morally corrupt, financially corrupt. So they hated their leaders. They also hated Israel. But hopefully people realize, all right, there's money that's poured in international aid on unprecedented levels. You are now second, third generation refugees, which is unheard of. We talked about the reality of UNRWA last week, the UN relief organization that just focuses on the Palestinians. It's utterly ridiculous what's happened, and the false hope that's been put in their hearts, and the right of return for Palestinians around the world. It's utterly cruel. Hopefully, reality can set in, and Israel can work with other parts of the world to rebuild Gaza, and for better leadership to be raised up. That's the goal. That's the hope. Is it Pollyannish? We can certainly pray for it. Until final conflict arrives in Israel and with the end of the age, why not pray for peace? Why not pray for security? Why not pray for people to be able to have their kids playing in the playground without fear and knowing they can get an education and have a future? I'm talking about on all sides. All right. I was texted a question by a colleague today, a fellow Jewish believer, who asked what many have asked. Why was Jesus killed? Why did he die on Passover, in conjunction with Passover, rather than Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement? After all, his death is the atoning sacrifice for our sins. After all, this was the whole purpose of him coming into the world, yes, to teach, to reveal who God was to us, to set captives free, to prepare the way for the kingdom of God coming to this world. But the heart and soul of his mission was to die for our sins and to rise from the dead, to take upon himself the guilt and sin of the whole world. And that's certainly typified on Yom Kippur in Leviticus 16th chapter, where you had two goats that were centrally involved. One goat for the Lord, one goat for the Lord would be killed and its blood offered on the altar. And this was for the purging of the sins of Israel. There were other sacrifices that were for the purging of the tabernacle itself, because it dwelt in the midst of Israel's uncleanness and itself got polluted. Like if you go into a room where everyone's smoking, you come out smelling like smoke. So some of the sacrifices were for the purging of the tabernacle and the items, and others for the removal of sin, the atonement of sin, cleansing. So that goat's blood did that. And then the goat in Hebrew for Azazel, which becomes known as the scapegoat, the goat that escapes into the wilderness, that the sins of the nation were confessed over that, including the pshaim, the rebellious acts, the transgressions, not just unintentional sins, but intentional, on the head of that goat. And then it was driven into the wilderness. And then in later rabbinic tradition, likely by the time of Jesus, for some time before the time of Jesus, I should say, that the tradition was that a scarlet thread was put on the horn, one of the horns of the goats, and it would be then driven out and pushed over a cliff. So it would actually be killed. But in early biblical times, it was just sent out into the wilderness. So wouldn't that be the logical time for Jesus to die because of what it symbolizes? symbolizes both the cleansing of sin and the removal of sin. And Jesus certainly fulfills when he says in Matthew 5:17, I didn't come to abolish the law of the prophets, but to fulfill. He certainly fulfills those two images of both goats, as well as the image of the high priest. So why not his death on the Day of Atonement? Well, we can only speculate based on what we know scripturally. One issue is that the Passover speaks of the liberation of the nation. It speaks of the liberation of the entire nation, freedom from captivity. And what the Messiah did was not just atoning, but it was also the sacrifice that liberated us from our captives, not just captivity to Egypt, but captivity to Satan and sin and the flesh and the world. So it is a massive moment of liberation, the Messiah's death on the cross. That's one thing. The second thing is, in the Passover sacrifice, what was emphasized? When I see the blood, God says, I will pass over you. The verb pasach, pass over, leap over, and then Pesach comes from that, Pesach being the Hebrew word for Passover. So that's the second thing. The blood of the Lamb, the blood of the Lamb, the blood of the Lamb, the conspicuous nature of this, every Israelite partaking in this with every family, killing a lamb, and then putting the blood of the Lamb on the doorposts of the homes. So that's another major reason. So it's the day of national liberation from slavery in Egypt. So the cross also affects that upon those who believe. A second thing is the emphasis on the blood. When I see the blood, I'll pass over you. Every Israelite family partaking in that also points to the Messiah's blood. And I would say a third reason is that it ties in with the imagery of the lamb. The lamb, the goat, saying that Jesus is the goat of God. Goats fight and kick, and it's a different image. He goes as a lamb. So Genesis 22, Abraham tells his son Isaac, God will provide the lamb for the sacrifice. Later, there's a ram provider. What happened to the lamb? In Isaiah 53, Kasela Tevach, like a sheep going to slaughter, the Messiah will die. So the imagery of the lamb is important. He is the sacrificial lamb. He lays down his life. He doesn't fight or rebel. He doesn't kick like a goat would kick and fight. So liberation for the nation, the emphasis on the blood, the emphasis on the lamb imagery. And then in the overall calendar, it fits in the plan of redemption because this is now the beginning of the Israelite calendar. And then what happens next? It ties in with unleavened bread, so the purifying process. Then what happens next is first fruits, which symbolizes the resurrection. And then 50 days after, Pentecost, Shavuot, the outpouring of the Spirit. So this is where it begins. And then ultimately, the images in the feast in the seventh month, they tie in with the second coming. The trumpet blast, right? Messiah appears with the blast of the trumpet, the shofar. The purging, national cleansing. So Zechariah 12, Zechariah 13, national cleansing. That's the atonement. And then Zechariah 14, Sukkot, celebration, where the nations come pouring into Jerusalem. So it fits the biblical calendar and imagery perfectly.